Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
If you look out west, we obviously have significant problems out west related to fire. That's a climate problem, but it's also a huge problem for those western communities and for the timber industry and others out there.
USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney.
We need to find markets for these materials. We need to manage those forests in a way that will reduce the impacts and severity of fire. And if we think about wood as a climate smart product, it's a climate smart commodity, we can help bolster some of those markets in the West. But here in East Texas or other parts of the South or other parts of the East where you have privately owned forests, there again, we need to create incentives for families to continue to own forest land and manage those lands in a way that can sequester carbon and produce wood products. And so thinking about forestry and active management as a climate smart approach to forestry is really, really important.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
See this red here? We're not going to even talk about 1965. We're going to go back and just stick with 2022. So functioning, you know, the last year's budget cycle. Remember, we're running on continuing resolutions, so there's all sorts of other budgetary malfeasance going on around here. But here's where we're at.
Representative David Schweikert is from Arizona on the House floor Thursday.
You see this red here? That's for last year's budget cycle. 71% of all the spending, and it's on autopilot. Because this is, hey, I turn 65, I get a health benefit. I work so many quarters, and I turn 65 or 70, wherever you choose, you get Medicare, Social Security, or you served in the military. Got to understand, the vast majority of your government is on autopilot. This blue here, that's defense. 13% of the 22 budget was defense. The other 16% was what we call non-defense discretionary. That's the EPA, that's the FBI, that's the Park Service, that's everything you actually think of as government is functionally only 16% of the spending. So there's a number of us who keep looking at different ideas and different numbers. And we keep trying to say, okay, what would happen if we actually took all the outlays and rolled them back to 2019, before the pandemic. But some of the math, and forgive me, but we were like working on this as we're walking over here to the floor. You got a math problem. First off, the discretionary is shrunk from, or is well, let's see, it's $52 billion bigger in 22 than it was in 2019. So that's real money. But what has exploded are two things. The mandatory, Social Security, Medicare, all these other things that are formula. And interest. 2019, we spent basically $376 billion in interest. We're functionally heading towards doubling that in the coming budget cycle. So you got to decide. If I could adopt the 2019 budget, we would actually, with the really substantial increases we've had in tax receipts, tax revenues, tax collections, whatever you want to call it, if we adopted the full 2019 budget, we would be even. How many members of Congress are ready to get up here and we're going to cut Medicare, we're going to cut Social Security, we're going to cut veterans benefits, we're going to actually somehow pay less interest on our debt? And this is the point I'm trying to make, is much, the vast majority of what is government is autopilot. And what we actually debate, the theater around here. So in 2019, 50% of what was we'll call discretionary, 50% was defense. The other 50% of that $1,330 billion, and half of it was true discretionary. I'm trying to make the point, if you're going to save us, it's got to be an actual discussion mostly about health care costs. I'm going to show you some boards here. And this is another one I bring back and forth. And I'm shocked how many, even my brothers and sisters who are, they actually get really upset with me on this. So you can't tell people that, but it's the math.
Representative David Schweikert from Arizona. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
An EPD is an acronym. It stands for Expected Progeny Difference.
Dr. Ryan Rathman's a beef cattle researcher and professor at Texas Tech University.
Each breed association generates specific EPDs for their population, working in tandem with other folks, statisticians and other groups, academicians that help them estimate those EPDs, but basically what they are is it's just a statistical estimate, the genetic merit of that animal for a specific trait, right? So most of us are probably most familiar with like a birth weight EPD or a weaning weight EPD, which would probably be the two most important EPDs for commercial cattlemen. And so if you go to bull sale, you can compare two bulls, and one may have, let's say, a zero for a birth weight EPD to 0.0, and maybe you're comparing them to a bull that's got a 5.0 birth weight EPD. Well, it's just a direct comparison between two animals of the same breed. And if we held the environment constant and we bred them to similar cows genetically, then we would expect a 5-pound difference in birth weight between their progeny. We have to hold the environment constant. We have to hold, obviously, the consideration of the genetics on the maternal side constant, because, they play a heavy role and can change things. And so we're holding those constant, and we're just looking at what would be the, in this case, the genetic birth weight growth difference between these two animals' progeny. And it's one thing that people get a little bit confused on as they start to look at EPDs is they want to look at an EPD and maybe say, well, what size calves would this bull throw? Can I look at that EPD and say he'd throw an average of, 75-pound birth weight? And you can't do that because, if just using my example of Montana versus Texas, well, Montana's going to have bigger birth weights than what Texas does. As we get in hotter, more humid climates, the calf birth weight tends to shrink just a bit. And so we're not saying that or suggesting that with EPDs. We're just saying in a common environment, what would the genetic difference be between those two animals?
He also talks about EPDs across breeds.
That's one thing that honestly gets a little bit tough, I think, to keep up with sometimes, and gets a little overwhelming. I don't even know. The Angus Association has well over 25 different EPDs, and some associations have less. And so, for example, there may be some associations that have what we call a stability EPD, which is probably one of the most economically relevant EPDs that most people don't know about in commercial business, but it basically estimates the longevity of that bull's daughters in the herd out to at least 6 years of age. And so the higher the number, the more likely they are to remain in the herd until they're six, which is the average break-even age for a cow. They got to stay in the herd to at least six to pay for herself, because the first 2 years of her life, she didn't give you a product back. That EPD is found, in the Simmental Association, Angus, Red Angus. So there's probably more, but a handful of associations. And then it's not found in others. And so they maybe have different EPDs, and they may have different ways of measuring cow longevity, but it's not called stability. And so you got to do your homework. You got to get on the Breed Association's website. Every single one of them on their website in a very easy to find form are going to have the outlined EPDs in their breed, and they're going to define them. And so if you're serious about advancing your cow-calf program and buying the very best bulls you can, you may not be married to one breed. You shouldn't be, in my opinion. You need to, look across breeds and say, what breed would be the best fit for my environment and my cows and my market? And figure out, and always entertain or be open-minded to something else. Because at the end of the day, you still make money. It doesn't matter what breed you do it with. And so explore across breeds, but you're going to have to do a little bit of homework and go to their websites and figure out what EPDs do they have. And then out of the 20, 25, 30 EPDs they have, which one are important to me? And so that's important to figure, so you're comfortable with the EPDs that each breed's using.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One thing I would caution people about it, and again, this is just kind of my goofy way of seeing the world. I think it's dangerous to think about going back to the ranch or back to the farm.
So why is that dangerous? Tom Field is the director of the College of Ag Sciences and Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
Because if you think about that, the phraseology of it, and you think I'm going back, to me that signals I'm looking backwards at, and it's not that the things that were done previously to my generation weren't good, but if I'm not thinking about how to take the farm forward, I'm making a massive mistake, right? So when I hear people say, I'm going to go back to the ranch, right? And I've come from a ranching culture, and I catch myself saying, I'm going to go back to the ranch. Well, what does that really mean? Or am I going to take the ranch forward? So in that process, I think families and young people need to ask themselves two fundamental questions at these sort of translational times when generations are starting to get reengaged. And the first one is to ask, and I think strategy comes from this question, is what would it take to be best in the world at what we currently do? Okay, and that's worth thinking about. Not that and best in world, you can define that world as your province or your state, your county, your township, whatever, but get it framed. And then the second question I love actually better is, what if we were starting from scratch?
Good question.
What would we do with this resource? What would we do if we started from scratch? And what that does is that opens the door for the full talent spectrum. So I've got a couple of biases in this space. Number one, I think the biggest mistake we've made in agriculture historically is that we have put women on the sidelines. Dumb move. That's putting half your team on the sidelines saying don't get on the field. That's crazy, right? You can't win with half your team on the sideline. So we got everybody on the field. That's starter.
Field also serves as director of the Engler Agribusiness Entrepreneur Program at the University of Nebraska.
So the second thing is we don't like the term trailing spouse, but it seems to be the term we use. So we forget about, you know, when that next generation is coming, oftentimes they're bringing a spouse, male or female, who doesn't come from agriculture and might actually not want to make their life the farm. What a surprise. How could that possibly be? And if we actually, though, engage them and say, okay, is this an opportunity for us? Like, you know, as I was listening to the introductions, I mean, you know, Catherine, like, do you sleep? Because you're a busy lady, right? But you're
since March,
you
know,
right, how to play in this multiple role space. And that's what young entrepreneurs have to figure out.
It was part of a North American Ag Roundtable virtual event a couple of years ago and concluded by saying,
and then the last thing I would say is, any young person coming back, before you come back, go forward, whatever phrase we use, do the Australian thing. Take a one-year walkabout.
Love it.
Do the Australian thing. Do a one-year walkabout and go see the rest of the world and learn from other people who will love you in a different way than your parents do. And I think if you're an existing farmer today and you've been at it for 20, 25 years and you've got a generation back, do them and yourself a favor. Take a month off and don't call home. The place will still be standing when you get back.
That's Tom Field, director of the College of Ag Sciences and Natural Resources, University of Nebraska at Lincoln. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Over the next 30 years, so starting today, 30 years from now.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert on the floor of the House Thursday.
And I'm getting tired of hearing myself say this, but I can't seem to get my brothers and sisters around here to digest the number. You're functionally, we're going to borrow $114 trillion in today's dollars. $38 trillion of that is the shortfall in Social Security. When you add up, here's our shortfall and here's our financing costs. $80.5 trillion are the shortfall in Medicare. So about 25. How many politicians do you hear? How many accountants? How many smart people do you see talking on financial television say, hey, we're heading towards a debt crisis and it's healthcare costs? Oh, by the way, the rest of the federal budget actually has about $1.9 trillion positive balance. And you got to understand, it's autopilot. These are earned benefits. Your society, your government, your country made a deal with you. You work this many quarters, you reach this certain age, you're part of a certain tribal group, other things, you get these benefits. Fine. You think back 20 years ago, if we had taken parts of a little sliver of Social Security and allowed the individual to put it in private accounts, the accounts would have been so much more robust. Democrats absolutely demagogued that. Oh, this is the end of the world. And now we're here 20 years later, and we're a decade away from the Social Security Trust Fund being gone. How many members here get behind these microphones are willing to tell their constituents the truth that you're heading towards about a 25 to 27% cut in Social Security unless we come up with some big, bold solution. And the problem is the concept, oh, let's just raise taxes. Except the problem is that's just the Social Security portion. The Medicare is 3/4 of all the coming debt. And the amount of taxes you have to raise, are you prepared for the amount that that actually starts to slow down the economy? So there's another board. I have not shown this one in about a year. This is actually 2020 data. The numbers are actually much worse today because the healthcare inflation, you know, I live in a place that has about 12% inflation. We're the highest in the continental United States, the Phoenix Scottsdale area. But base inflation, healthcare inflation has been up around 16%. So these numbers are much uglier today. And this is really uncomfortable, and this makes people upset, but it is the math. A typical couple retiring. So let's say you're retiring right now. You function, you're going to receive $3 for every dollar you put in. It's the math. Now, on Social Security, you get what you put back in. You get a little bit of a spiff, but if you'd actually been able to put those dollars into the markets or into some other, you know, a bond, you'd have much better. But on Social Security, you basically get back what you put in. Okay? Problem is, for that couple, on Medicare taxes, you will have paid about $161,000 in taxes, and you're going to get about $522,000 in benefits. It is this gap right here that bankrupts your country. It's healthcare costs.
And that comes as the Senate passes an $858 billion National Defense Authorization Act. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
From a historical standpoint, if you go all the way back to the early 1900s and then through, you know, about the 1960s and 70s, stock shows were really, really important. Important because we didn't have EPDs. If we were going to make comparisons across herds of beef cattle, then we had to bring them to a common place. And we used basically just subjective phenotypic evaluation to try to determine which of those cattle were more superior.
Dr. Ryan Rathman, beef cattle researcher and professor at Texas Tech.
So people would take note of that. And, you know, it would make a difference, I'm sure, in terms of their marketing, you know, who had the upper hand, just like it somewhat does today. But the cattle that were most widely used in the commercial sector were cattle that were, you know, legitimately winning at some of our national and state level stock shows. And so that was all good and fine. But the problem with that is most everybody in our audience probably knows, is it's heavily influenced by the environment.
So today we rely on EPDs. Are they reliable?
I think that's probably the most important question. When you start asking different cattlemen, you know, do they use EPDs or not? If they respond and say, no, I just don't believe the numbers. When I go to bull sale or I go buy bulls or heifers or whatever, but mainly buying bulls, I just don't think they're true. I don't think they're legitimate. So I just I put that paper in my back pocket, or I just don't pay any attention to it, and I go use my eye and I find the best bulls. Well, you know, I kind of already alluded to why that's maybe a little bit of a mistake to not pay attention to them, because, you know, inherently you're going to be drawn to the bulls that, you know, and I'm a livestock judge, and so I'm big on phenotype, but inherently you're going to be drawn to bulls that are fatter, more in you know, appealing shape, more massive. But, you know, if a producer fed them really well, took care of them to the nth degree, you know, they're going to look good. You know, fat sales in the bull market. But, you know, at the same time, just because the bull looks good, that is a suggestion of underlying very good genetics, but it's not a guarantee. You know, he may look good mainly because of just that real favorable environment that producer provided for him. And so at the end of the day, all that bull can do is transmit his genetics to his progeny. And so anything that's going to make a difference in my operation is dependent on that. And so I'm after his breeding value, his real genetics. And so, you know, are they reliable? Well, any data that we collect, it's only as good as the person measuring it, you know? And so if the producers that are, you know, raising cattle in the seed stock sector are of high moral compass, you know, that they're doing things on the up and up. And when I say that, I'm saying things like, hey, are they accurately reporting the parents? Because that's a big consideration. And sometimes they mistakenly do it, but you don't want to work with anybody, obviously, that would, you think would have a reputation of misidentifying the parents. Because the EPD all starts with that, is identifying who's the sire, who's the dam. And basically the progeny are just an average of the two parents' EPDs to begin with. And so if we misidentify one of the parents, we've made a grave error and the data is going to be completely unreliable. Kind of as an off note, just to, you know, how often does that happen? Like I said, I think most of the time it just happens because it's accidental. You know, if you've been in a cow-calf business, it's pretty easy. I'm sure we've all had experiences where a calf, and you may not even realize it, but calves may be born at the same time, cows may be calving at the same time, and they don't pair up the way that they should have. We may get calves that switch mothers. It just may be difficult to get things addressed. Even on the sire side, obviously, we may have a bull get in our pasture and breed a few cows or jump back or, you know, things like that. There's just things that can happen. I was talking to someone at the Simmental Association that leads our genetic programs, and he estimated that probably somewhere between about 7 and 11% of the cattle in that association were misidentified. And I'd have to say that, you know, that would probably be, like I said, not because of deliberate falsification, but I'd say it's probably pretty accurate across most breeds. And so, you know, nowadays we have DNA tests, and those DNA tests can validate whether or not the parents that you're trying to register that animal to are in fact legitimately their parents, right? And so that's good technology. And so you want to work with producers that probably take those measures to go ahead and parent verify all their progeny.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A lot of farms I work with are stuck, and the conflict avoidance is because of this, which is finding fairness in farm transition.
Elaine Fries is from Manitoba, a farm family coach at Seeds of Encouragement.
The first one is financial transparency. How much can come to us in our family for income, and how much debt servicing capacity do we have? Oh, and by the way, that trailing spouse that Tom talked about, do they like to sleep with a $600,000 operating line, or is that pushback city? So fairness is helping everyone in your family be successful, including the non-business heirs. And that's where the tension is in the family, because we have two systems at play here. And this is life-changing when you get this in your head, is we all want to be part of a family, which is the heart of our business. And that family system has certain goals and roles and things and ways of being. But then we also have our farm or ranch business. And what gets really mucky is when these two systems are intermeshed and they're fighting against each other rather than going with the same vision and passion. And, you know, folks, I wish I didn't have to tell this story, but I'm on week 24 of being not on an airplane as a professional speaker. And that's okay, because every week since March, I've had two families reach out to me saying, help, we need to communicate better. So here's your action plan. Have a good talk with yourself. What is the current role that you love, that gives you passion and joy about a good day on the ranch and the farm? So what do you expect from yourself? Secondly, talk to your spouse. What do they expect? And do you both have the same vision and timeline for how life is going to be for the next 5 years, 10 years and beyond? Oh, and by the way, how are you going to pay for that lifestyle? And as farm professionals, we need to build a trusted team of advisors and know that we're on a journey. This is not Roundup. This is not a 10-day solution. Bang, you're done. The other thing I want you to do in this time, after you get off this call today, I want you to phone your lawyer, because you're going to make an appointment to update your will. And those of you who are Mark's age or younger with young children, and Mark, I'm talking to you because I don't know your personal situation, but Mark, if you don't have a will, I'm going to kick your butt. Because I meet so many young families who are in all this busyness, but they haven't done the basic things to protect that commitment to action and to commit to protecting the risk of the farm. You can call your lawyer. And now that we're in COVID, you can actually get your wills digitally signed. You don't even have to be physically present anymore in the legal office to do that. So that's an estate plan, which is different from what your transition plan, because the transition is the transition of labor, management, and ownership. And what young farmers are dying to know is, when will I know? And William Bridges calls this the pain of not knowing, or the neutral zone. And we all know that driving a truck is, if you're in neutral, you're not going anywhere. And that's a really stuck place to be. So as a farm family coach, I'm imploring you to use this time to get clarity about what you expect and what your parents or the next gen two expects. Find out what are the timelines that you can chunk this down on your journey, because the other thing that's killing agriculture is a sense of anxiety and overwhelm. And if we had that in February, how much more of that do we have that now in August, right? So how do you decrease anxiety and overwhelm? Is you start acting one step at a time.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The left is absolutely fixated on methane. Okay, methane is a huge greenhouse gas. Okay, we'll give them that. Now, you know, a couple years ago, we had to recalculate its half-life. It's down to, what, 8-9 years for those of us who actually geek out on this stuff. And, oh, we need to start shutting down use of hydrocarbons.
Representative David Schweikert from Arizona on the House floor Thursday.
We need to start calculating the, you know, methane load for any barrel of oil or any BTU of gas. And then there's articles out there saying, you know, there's actually a really cheap solution. And I'm going to be a little silly. I believe it's copper oxidized clay. It's kitty litter. Do you know you can take a well or some other methane production source and it absorbs like a sponge, and it's dirt cheap. You know why? Because it's dirt.